Thanks. Thank you so much for coming out and supporting WEFT, supporting WEFT. We are on a 70-city Exception to the Rulers book and media tour, celebrating media in this country that is the exception to the rulers. It should not just be our motto at Democracy Now! Or a description of your precious radio station here. It should be what all media is. There is a reason why our profession, journalism, is the only one enshrined in the Constitution, protected by it, because it is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. It holds a government accountable. It is the check and balance. And yet the media has reached an all-time low in this country. I come from Pacifica Radio, which was founded 55 years ago this week by a man named Lou Hill, who was a conscientious objector. He refused to fight in World War II, and when he came out of the detention camps, he said there has to be a media outlet that's not run by corporations that profit from war, but run by journalists and artists. Not run by corporations that, Professor George Gerbner says, corporations that have nothing to tell and everything to sell, that are raising our children today. And so Pacifica Radio was born. April 15th at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Lou Hill went on the air and welcomed people to the airwaves of KPFA. Now, he had to give out FM radios because FM was in its infancy. And then, of course, when people finally got the radios and they tuned in, they were begging for money from the listeners. But really, as I try to convince myself each time that I do it, it is a very profound practice. Putting your, basically going on the corner and shaking that tin cup. It's about independence. Pacifica pioneered the idea of listener sponsorship. The idea that we won't turn to corporations, making back slick room deals with them so you're not quite sure where the information is coming from. It can be a little tedious, I know. But we thank you for being there, and I hope every last one of you has paid your pledge. How many of you haven't done it yet? Mick, I know you're taking notes here. KPFA was the first station, then KPFK in Los Angeles, then WBAI in New York. WPFW went on the air in 1977 in Washington, D.C., KPFT in Houston, 1970. It's the only radio station in the country, the Houston station, that when it went on air, its transmitter was blown up twice. It was blown up by the Ku Klux Klan. And when the Exalted Cyclops, or was it the Grand Dragon? I confused their titles, went on trial. He said it was his proudest act. Why? Because I think he understood how dangerous Pacifica Radio is. Dangerous because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone describing their own experience, it breaks down stereotypes and caricatures that fuel the bigotry that feeds these groups like the KKK. Fast forward to the Persian Gulf War. That time, Westinghouse-owned, CBS, General Electric-owned NBC, two of the major nuclear weapons manufacturers in the world, making most of the parts for most of the weapons in the Persian Gulf War. Was it any accident what we watched on TV was a military hardware show? It's got to change. And now the media, as low as it could possibly be, simply serving as a conveyor belt for the lies of the administration. You look at the lead up to war, the drumbeat, the rollout. No, that's not my word. That's Andrew Card's word. In The Exception to the Rulers, we talk about the ascendancy of the oligarchy. You have Andrew Card, right, the chief of staff. He's a former GM lobbyist. You have Bush at the top. He's a failed oil man. You have Dick Cheney. He's number two man. He's the former head of the largest oil services corporation in the world. Condoleezza Rice had the Condoleezza Rice named after her. That is a Chevron oil tanker. And it goes on from there. You've got Abraham Spencer, you've got Don Evans, all of them representing oil companies. And you look at what's happening in Iraq today. Fallujah, fierce fighting. Basra, 20 kids just killed blowing up a bus. In Fallujah, snipers, U.S. snipers on top of buildings. In Baghdad, well, it's a disaster right now. I mean, Bush has managed to accomplish something Saddam Hussein could never do, and that was unite the Sunnis and the Shias. What will happen there, I don't know. We do know that Bush has just nominated John Negroponte, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., to head what will be the largest U.S. embassy in the world come June 30th. 3,000 people, 500 CIA. John Negroponte, who is he? He was the former ambassador to Honduras, 1981 to 1985, which was a staging ground for the illegal Contra War. You know, Congress had voted, you cannot give weapons or funding to this band of thugs, the Contras, that killed so many Nicaraguans. But the Reagan-Bush administration got around it, and John Negroponte was at the heart of it. In Honduras, they had a death squad, a U.S.-trained death squad, the Battalion 316. And Honduras started with something like $4 million in military aid. It went up to almost $80 million under Negroponte. He denied the military abuses. He had denied the disappearances, and yet he knew every step of the way what was happening. And then you fast forward 20 years and you wonder what's going to happen when he's in charge of perhaps the largest counterinsurgency program in the world. It's frightening. We don't know how many Iraqi civilians have died, well over 10,000. We believe we do know how many U.S. soldiers, over 700. The casualties, the injuries, that number is not very often mentioned, over 18,000 servicemen and women medically evacuated from Iraq. You know how many more are sick there? They are desperately trying to hang on to soldiers in Iraq, you know, canceling their leaves, extending their stays. So you could only imagine how many times the 18,000 that have been medically evacuated. Some water. I come from New York, right next to Ground Zero. Democracy Now! Broadcasts from an old 100-year-old firehouse, Engine Company 31, that's been converted into a community media center. On September 11th, we were doing a special that day. You know, the planes hit when Democracy Now! Was broadcasting the show. We used to broadcast at 9 every morning. The first plane hit the first tower of the World Trade Center at 8:47. We didn't know what had happened, though we were very nearby. We were in the garret without windows. 9 o'clock, we went on the air. At 9:03, the second plane hit the second tower. We heard an explosion. We didn't know what it was. We kept broadcasting. We were doing a special that day on the significance or the connection between September 11th and terror. That's September 11th, 1973. The day Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile, died in the palace as the U.S.-backed, Kissinger-backed, Nixon-backed Pinochet regime rose to power, killing thousands of people. Thank you. And that day we were doing a program because more documents had been declassified implicating Henry Kissinger in that coup. September 11, 2001, 3,000 people were incinerated in a moment, though we will never know exactly how many people died, because those who go uncounted in life go uncounted in death. And they're the undocumented workers who worked at the World Trade Center. Their families too afraid to come forward because of the increasingly close relationship between the police and the INS, the immigration authorities, afraid that if they came forward, they too could perhaps, well, they might be detained. They could be deported, like so many thousands of people have. We don't even know their names. After September 11th, we stayed in the firehouse to broadcast the voices of people who had come from ground zero, people who had lost loved ones, because as what was happening in New York was taking place, we could see the war machine gearing up in Washington. So we didn't leave. We were in the evacuation zone. The military, the police, the National Guard had sealed off our area. And if we went outside, we knew that they would take us. As soon as our engineer went out to go up north to get us food, he wasn't able to cross back over. Late at night, I would go out and I would see those pictures go up all over the familiar pictures, the color Xeroxes of the people who lost loved ones at the World Trade Center, the pictures of the loved ones. And first there were dozens and hundreds and thousands everywhere. They were up on lampposts, they were up on hospital buildings, they were up all over the city in parks. They plastered the parks. And they said things like, they show a picture of a woman, "If you've seen my wife, last seen on the 87th floor of the World Trade Center, please call her husband," and it would give a number. Picture of a young man, and it would say, "If you've seen my son, last building 2 on the 12th floor, please call his mother," and it would give a number. And I thought about how strangely familiar these pictures were, how similar they were to the pictures on the placards that the mothers of the disappeared carried in Argentina and the Plaza de Mayo. The mothers of the disappeared. "Have you seen my granddaughter? Have you seen my grandson?" See, on that day, September 11th, we were all united in grief, united all over the world. People in Yugoslavia who knew pain, they were bombed by the United States. They grieved for Americans. People in Palestine who know so much pain, they grieve for Americans. People who knew the most pain grieve for us because they knew how it felt. We were all united in that grief and all united against terror. When Bush came to Ground Zero, it's hard to call him President Bush, maybe Resident Bush, resident of the White House, a man who was not popularly elected president. He was selected president. And yet, this man who did not have the mandate of the people has declared war on the world. But when he came to Ground Zero, a chant went up around him. It said, "USA, USA." And it sent a chill through me. Not that I didn't understand the sentiment, but that's not the answer to what happened on September 11th. It is a global community united against terror. And in order to do that, we have to have a universal standard of justice. For example, an international criminal court where people are tried who are alleged to have committed war crimes or crimes against humanity. I think Osama bin Laden and his accomplices should be tried before an international criminal court and, if found guilty, severely punished. But I also think Henry Kissinger should be tried and, if found guilty, severely punished. And I don't say that lightly. You look at Chile, you look at the number of Chileans who died over the 17 years. You look at Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. I don't know how many of you saw Fog of War, that Errol Morris film about McNamara. My craving after seeing that film was to hear a Vietnamese woman speak uninterrupted for 2 hours. I want to hear people at the target end, not just learn about those who perpetrated the crimes, reflecting. It's not enough for me. But Kissinger in Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos, Kissinger in Chile, Kissinger's giving the green light for Indonesia to invade Timor, which led to one of the great genocides of the 20th century, 200,000 Timorese killed. He and President Ford at the time in 1975 went to Indonesia, the capital Jakarta, met with the long-reigning dictator Suharto and allowed Suharto to invade East Timor December 7th, 1975. 90% of the weapons used were from the United States. And as Kissinger took off and the soldiers invaded Timor, State Department officials could see very well what was happening, how bloody that invasion was, and they started cabling Kissinger, the U.S. Congress is going to cut off aid to Indonesia if this continues. They're not going to stand for this aggressive act. And when Kissinger came back, did he thank them for following the events and then figure out what to do? No, he called them together and castigated them for leaving a paper trail saying, we will not kick our ally in the teeth. The person who took the notes at that meeting that have since been declassified was one Jerry Bremer. Yes, L. Paul Bremer, who's now in charge of Iraq. He learned well at his master's knee. We have to take these records seriously because the rest of the world does. We see the effects, and it's very dangerous. On a lighter note, during the Persian Gulf War, I had the chance to speak about war on the Sally Jesse Raphael show. How many of you remember that program? You know, the women's talk show in the afternoon that reaches millions of women. How many of you know this story? Okay. Then you can correct me if I make any mistakes. I get this call. The U.S. has just started bombing Iraq, and I was railing on the radio against the bombing of the cradle of civilization back to the cradle. And a volunteer runs in. It was during fundraising drive. And she says, Sally, just Raphael show. They're on the line. Pick up the phone. I said, right. And I just kept talking. No, she comes back. Yes, really? I said, yeah, really. Now, volunteers are the heart of every radio community radio station. I just thought this one was hallucinating. So anyway, finally, just to appease her, I picked up the phone. And it was a producer from the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and she was in her limousine, she said. She was listening to the show. I guess her chauffeur had turned it on. And she asked if I'd come on. So I said, sure. They said, come in 2 days. We're going to do a program on war, and we'd like you to speak. So I thought about what I would wear. It's a big national program, you know. Maybe should I dress as a man, dressed as a woman, dressed as a man, dressed as a woman? I didn't want to be out of place. But anyway, I figured out what to wear, and I went on over. And when we got there, they separated the three women for war from the three women against the war. We'd be in different green rooms so that we'd really mix it up when we got it out there, that the fireworks would happen on stage. Actually, I liked what the producer said. I mean, she said, I want this show to work. She said, I think we can get the same kind of ratings for a program like this that Sally gets for all the others. I want to prove it. Don't be afraid to shout out, to express your opinion, to really, well, to duke it out on the stage. I said, well, sure. You know, I don't think it matters whether you work in the system or outside the system. What matters is that you're able to accomplish something there. That's what matters. And when you feel stymied for a long period of time, you got to keep trying for a little while, but then you have to make a decision. Anyway, I thought she was on to something, and I wanted to help her out. So we went on the stage, and all five women besides me were military. Three pro-war military women and two anti-war military women and me. So the music came up, Sally came out, the lights came on, the show was being recorded, it would air in a few days. And Sally immediately gave the microphone to someone in the audience, a woman who said, I'm really afraid of Saddam Hussein's biological and chemical weapons. To which the woman next to me, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn, who is an army captain trained as a doctor, she said she would not go to the Gulf because she was trained to save lives, not take them. She said, I share your concern, but I'm also concerned about the biological and chemical weapons right here in the United States. And before she could get out the word states, Sally came barreling down the aisle, shouting, "You be quiet. You shut up. This is my show. You get out." And she is barreling down the aisle. I mean, I had not really seen this show very much before. You know the whole Jerry Springer thing? I thought she was going to strike Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn. She wasn't stopping. She was going faster and faster. And so as she came up on the stage, I said, "Whoa, Sally, back off." Meanwhile, in the audience, they had told us to bring our friends, so I brought a group of people from BAI, and they started chanting, "Free speech, free speech." You know, you can dress them up, but you can't take them anywhere. So anyway, Sally started to break down. Her producers came out, and they started to rock her back and forth. And they were saying, "It's okay, Sally, it's okay." All six of us women were staring. It was our one moment of unity. Staring in shock. Had she truly never heard an anti-war point of view? Is she that isolated? Are they all on the corporate networks? I mean, Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn was hardly threatening. She was an Army captain. She looked more like, well, an Amish woman, dressed in a long black dress, hair tied back, big glasses, hands clasped in her lap. Very soft-spoken. Somehow the producers convinced Sally to carry on with the taping of the program. And so we did, except with one caveat. We were to raise our hands if we had anything to say. I mean, I had never seen anything like this except on Sesame Street, but we agreed. And so we carried on with this hour discussion, and it really was very good. Sally first asked, who were these people? She showed videotape of the protesters in Washington, and I raised my hand, and I mean, I didn't know everyone's name, but I applauded her for showing the images of people protesting in the street. She said, why are they doing this? And I said, well, I think they're doing their what they see as their patriotic duty. I mean, this was winter, Persian Gulf War. They could be staying home with their families or their TV sets. They didn't have to come out in the street. 10,000 people. I mean, also, how many people identify when they see 10,000 people marching in the streets? Most Americans don't. It is a bit alienating. Why do they do it? Well, they do it because they can only hope that on a global warming day, a CBS executive will open his window and perhaps their chant of no war will waft in and hit an open microphone. They don't have the luxury of being invited into one of these network studios, like Henry Kissinger, for example, and explain why he supports every war. No, they have to yell and scream. It's not dignified, doesn't sound very civilized, but that's the approach the networks take to people who engage in dissent, who don't agree with the establishment revving up for war. And we had this kind of conversation. I said, as the granddaughter of an Orthodox rabbi, I'm horrified to see little Israeli children wearing gas masks, but I am more horrified to see little Palestinian children without gas masks. And that's the kind of conversation we had. At the end of the hour, a cameraman gave me a thumbs up, and we went back to WBAI. And they said 2 days it would air. 2 days came and went. People were calling, when's the show going to be on? I called the Sally Jesse Raphael show, and they said, funny you should call. There was a problem, a technical problem with the, you see, it's very technical, but with the video and the soundtrack, there was a syncing problem as my spirit started to sink. And I said, oh, come on. There was a problem with the sound of our voices. Let's be real. And she said, don't be like that. We'll have you back sometime. I said, right. First of all, you can't because Dr. Yolanda Hewitt Vaughn is about to be court-martialed. She would serve a year and a half in the brig in prison, her husband raising their three young children alone. It's amazing. I told this story this morning in St. Louis, and afterwards at the book signing, a young man came up to me, and he said, "Hi, my name is Emiliano Hewitt Vaughn. You were describing my mother." And I asked, "How old were you then?" And he said, "I was 8 years old." So he was the oldest. And I said, "Did I get her right? Did she look kind of Amish?" And he said, "I guess you could say that." But I said that, you know she's not going to be able to join us, and you know you're not going to do it. And I'd like to speak to the executive producer. And they said, "He's a very busy man." I said, "Well, and how exactly did you learn about this technical problem? Remember that cameraman giving me the thumbs up? He didn't seem very disturbed." And she said, "Well, Chicago and Minneapolis, the stations called. We sent out the videotape, and they said it was just unacceptable. So I called those stations. I said I was a concerned viewer. I asked to speak to the operations director, who doesn't get very many calls, so he took the call. And he said, "Funny you should ask about that war show, because New York just called and told us to pull it. And we're scrambling to get another Sally Jesse Raphael show to replace it." So called back, said, "The jig is up. I want to talk." And so did a lot of people who were calling BAI. I said, "Don't call us. Call them. Don't bog down our switchboard." And I guess they got a lot of calls. Well, I know they got hundreds of calls. Maybe they got more than that, because 2 years later, a producer met me in an elevator, bumped into me and said, "You know, you guys closed down our program for 2 days. We could not even function with the number of calls coming in." I was shocked by that, actually. Shows the power of media activism. Anyway, all I know is I got a call the next day from a very frantic producer who said, "The executive producer would like to speak to you." I said, "I'm a very busy woman." Anyway, they asked if I would cry censorship if they edited the program. I said, "Of course not. I'm an editor too. You have every right. It's your program. I assume you'll edit out Sally's fit." And they did, and it ran the next day. But because they held on to it, it ran with headlines that said, "Things get messy with Sally Jesse." And the most interesting response I got was from women on Southern military bases who called to say, "We agree with you. We have never heard this view on television before. We whisper it to each other. But we can't have these discussions on military bases." I mean, they're being sent, or their loved ones are being sent, to kill or be killed. I don't know which is worse. But they didn't want to do it. They didn't believe it was right. They rely on us and civilian society to have the discussions they can't have on these bases. And it is the mass media that is supposed to provide a forum for these discussions about the most important issues of our day: life and death, war and peace. And anything less than that is a disservice to the service men and women of this country. Anything less than that is a disservice to a democratic society. It's not just Pacifica Radio, Community Radio, NPR, PBS that are using the public airwaves. They are too. NBC, CBS, ABC. It's public property. And we have a sacred responsibility to use it to further a democratic society. But I also have a lot of hope. I have hope because you're all here supporting independent media, and independent media is growing like never before. By the way, Dennis and Chuck are handing around clipboards that are our daily digest, our email list. And I hope all of you have signed them. Chuck and Dennis, have you passed out the daily digest email clipboards? It sounds like they've got them. They show you the news headlines, our alerts every day. And they connect you to us whenever we're putting out information. Democracy Now! Started in 1996, but a few years ago, we were a couple dozen stations. Now, over 220 radio and television stations, public access TV, Pacifica and NPR stations, community stations, Dish Network, Free Speech TV, which is channel 9415 of Dish Network. We broadcast four times a day. We have just gone on PBS, and another PBS station is about to pick us up. We are broadcasting across Canada, across Australia, and Europe on radio stations. We are broadcasting video and audio streaming at democracynow.org. If you ever miss the show, one day you can see it or listen to it. It's the largest public media collaboration in this country. It's absolutely remarkable. 2 to 3 stations a week are picking us up. There is a hunger right now for independent voices. Now, we saw the power of it just in the last few weeks. I just came back from the Central African Republic. Those of you who are concerned about what happened to Jean-Bertrand Aristide, you wouldn't know that a democratically elected leader was just overthrown in our hemisphere with U.S. involvement, which means in your name, with your tax dollars, if you were wondering where they're going recently as you were paying your taxes. But Democracy Now! Broke the story nationally and globally of what Aristide said. Ousted in the early mornings of February 29th, number two man in the U.S. Embassy goes to his home and says, "You're going to be killed. Thousands of Haitians will die. The rebels are coming. We can't protect you." Instead of moving in the U.S. soldiers a day before, they move them in a day after they oust Aristide. Aristide says he wants to talk to the press. He thinks he's being taken to the press. Instead, he's put on a plane with dozens of U.S. military and security. Doesn't know where they're going, even though the U.S. administration is saying the Aristides are fleeing to a destination of their choosing. Mildred Aristide tries to pick up the shade, the First Lady of Haiti, in the plane window. They tell her to put it down. 24 hours later, they end up dumped in the Central African Republic, a remote area of Africa, one plane out a week, hardly any electricity or phone service. Dictator rose to power a year ago in a coup. The U.S. really knows how to choose them. We got a call finally saying where they were from U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters and Randall Robinson, founder of Trans Africa, saying, "Quick, put us on the air. They have just called us. We need to let the American people know what has happened." We went on the air live because we closed caption our TV show, which now makes Pacifica Radio accessible to the deaf and the hard of hearing. Those transcripts we turn immediately, the closed captioning into transcripts, put it in our website. Reporters in Washington at the White House and the Pentagon took the transcripts and they challenged Rumsfeld an hour later at the Pentagon press briefing saying, "Is what Pacifica is saying true? Was Aristide kidnapped?" And he started to laugh. They said, "We didn't ask for a chuckle, we asked for an answer." He said, "It's ridiculous, but I've learned from my years as a reporter that when a politician tells you it's ridiculous, you're probably on the right track." 2 weeks later, this small delegation chartered a plane and flew two-thirds of the way around the world to take U.S. foreign policy in their own hands. I couldn't resist. I had to go to chronicle this absolutely historic trip. We went to Miami and then St. Thomas and then Dakar, Senegal, and then Bangui, Central African Republic, where they engaged in a high-stakes negotiation with the dictator for 7 hours to try to get Aristide freed. As Aristide said to me that night as we were waiting for the word to come down from on high, he's calling the United States and France to decide what to do. They were clearly calling the shots. And this small delegation was calling the bluff of the most powerful country on earth. They said, if he is a free man, if he chose to come here, then he can leave. Then he can't be held prisoner. Remarkable, this small group of people following the dictum of Margaret Mead, the anthropologist. Never doubt for a moment that a small group of thoughtful, committed people can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And they did succeed in wresting Aristide from the powers that be, got him onto a plane, and then we flew back from Central African Republic to Senegal to the Cape Verde Islands to Barbados. And when we landed, I learned from the Democracy Now! Newsroom that Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and Rumsfeld were all threatening that Aristide was not to return to this hemisphere. Whose hemisphere? And the U.S. ambassador to Haiti, James Foley, said he's not to return to within 150 miles of the country. Whose country? We have to look at the effect our policy has on people around the world. You know, when the snipers were loose in Washington, Delaware, Maryland, remember how frightening that was? We never knew who they were going to strike next. Everyone stayed home, hunkered down, terrified, millions, terrified of two guys with a high-powered rifle. And yet, they paralyzed the East Coast. Why? We never knew who they would strike next. I remember that time because Bush was giving his speech at the United Nations. And I came to the newsstand the next morning and I saw the tabloids with headlines. One said, "I am God." And the other one said, "Who's next?" I thought the tabloids had come to their sentences, their senses. A summary of Bush's speech, "I am God," and "Who's next?" No, they were talking about the snipers. But I thought about this. How does the rest of the world see us? They never know who we're going to strike next. We don't just have one high-powered rifle. We have the most powerful arsenal on earth. We struck Afghanistan, then slammed a missile into Yemen, then Iraq. And even before Iraq, we were talking about North Korea. We were talking about Iran. We were talking about Libya. Noam Chomsky says the way a superpower exerts power is not through being rational, but by being irrational. Because then you're scared. You're off balance. You don't know. The U.S. is engaged in a kind of global sniper politics. And that destabilizes the world. And we have to decide if that should be done in our name. I recently had a woman on our show from Guyana talking about globalization. And at the end of the conversation, I said, "Thank you very much." We now move on to our segment on U.S. elections. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute. And I said, "Thank you very much for joining us," as the other guest came in and said, "No, I'll be sitting here. I'll be a part of this next conversation." I said, no, because this is the next segment, and these guests are going to sit down, and we're done with our conversation. No, I'm going to be one of the guests on that segment. So really? And I said, as the music is, you know, fading out, and we are about to begin our discussion on the U.S. elections, why is that? And she said, "Because I believe everyone in the world should get to vote for president of the United States." Think about it. Who determines more of more people's lives than the person who is in the Oval Office? And what is going to be done about that this year? It really does matter what you do. It really does matter what the people who run against Bush do. There is a philosophy right now called ABB, anything but Bush. That is a very liberating philosophy for a politician. It means he can be anything he wants to be as long as he isn't George W. Bush. Though sometimes in the last week with John Kerry, I'm getting a little bit confused. He was on Tim Russert's Meet the Press and asked about the assassination of Rantisi, the Hamas leader. And he said he fully agreed with Bush supporting Sharon. Then he asked about Bush's stance on the settlements. He'd come out in a way that no previous president had, supporting Sharon. And he said he agreed, and agreed with no right of return for the Palestinians. And at the end, Russert said, "You agree with Bush completely? You agree with Bush?" And he said, "Yes." "Completely?" he said. He said, "Yes." This is the opposition candidate. And then he said he believed that we should send more troops to Iraq, and that's what Bush thinks. And then he said that he criticized what he had said about the Vietnam War. Highly decorated anti-war veteran, John Kerry, is a remarkable record, what he did in the past and how he spoke out when he came back. But now he is backpedaling on that, saying he doesn't agree with what he said. I think there was a reason he started to sound as anti-war as he did when Howard Dean was running. I mean, Dennis Kucinich has always said this, but in terms of who the media takes seriously, they took seriously Howard Dean, and this put John Kerry in an uncomfortable position since he was losing, and so he went with the flow, and he became increasingly Dean-esque. But then Dean left, and now all he is running against is the person he seems to be coming more like in terms of policy. And what will turn him around is what is people letting him know how they feel. The question is, I mean, he's just the consummate politician. He will respond to what people say. But we have seen this happen before. A politician who is hardly separating himself from the man he is running against. Just ask Al Gore what happened to him. These are very critical times. It does matter who is in the White House. I just end by saying, and then I'm going to sign books, and I hope to get to speak to each of you. By the way, if you get two books, you can get the DVD that we just showed for free. It has three films on it. It usually goes for $30 on our website, which you can get on our website. But we will give it to you for free if you get two books. Now, why would you get two books? Well, you could give one to someone you care about, or you could give one to one of these fine public spaces like WEFT that are so under-resourced, like the library, public library, prison library, high school library, college library. You can spread the information around. That's how we're going to do it. It also sends a very powerful message to those in publishing. There are these increasing number of conservative imprints at the publishing houses. People like O'Reilly have no trouble getting published. But we have to send a different message to the publishing industry. And that is, people are hungry for a different voice. And every book that succeeds in that world makes a space for another book, because publishers take a listen, a look. They care about markets. I don't call them markets. I call them communities of people and crossing borders into different communities. But it is so important that we support independent bookstores, pages for all ages, and that's what we're doing all over the country, supporting independent media, the entire media landscape. I'm just going to end by saying I have a tremendous amount of hope. I have hope because I think many of us have seen a lot of suffering in the world. Because of Pacifica Radio, people in this country know about what happened in Timor. I started the story before, the terrible genocide there, 75, Indonesia invaded, closed the country to the outside world for 17 years. I got a chance to go there in 1990 with my colleague Alan Nairn and return in 91. He was writing a piece for The New Yorker. I was doing a Pacifica documentary. November 12, 1991 will forever be seared in my memory and in history. The day thousands of Timorese marched against the Indonesian military for killing so many of their own. They marched to the cemetery, old women in traditional Timorese garb, girls in their Catholic school uniforms, boys in their school shorts. And they chanted, "Viva Independence, Viva East Timor, long live their country," though so many of their people had died. When we got to the cemetery, we saw the Indonesian military marching up on them. They were caught, the people, thousands of them defenseless by walls on either side of the cemetery. I'd always hidden my equipment because it would endanger the Timorese. Instead, this time, I took out my microphone. I held my camera above, Alan held the camera above his head. I put my headphones on. We walked to the front of the crowd, thought we could try to head off this attack, what looked like an imminent attack, if they just knew who we were. They had committed many massacres in the past, the Indonesian military, but never in front of Western journalists. So we went to the front of the crowd. The soldiers came marching up. They rounded the corner, carrying their US M16s at the ready position. And without any warning, without any provocation, without any hesitation, they just swept past us and they opened fire on the crowd, gunning people down from right to left. The first to go down, a little boy, as he exploded from the gunfire, and then they just kept on shooting. They beat us to the ground. Alan threw himself on top of me. They took their US M16s and they slammed them against his skull until they fractured it. We lay in the road. They lined up in firing squad fashion, put the guns to our heads, and they were screaming as others were killing the people around us. Politique, politique, because to bear witness is to be political. And they were saying, "Australia, Australia," asking if we were from Australia. 17 years before, when Indonesia invaded, there were only 6 reporters covering the events leading up to the invasion. 5 of them from Australian TV crews. The Indonesian military lined up against a house and they executed them all. The 6th, Roger East, was in a radio station in Dili, the capital of East Timor. They dragged him out of the station, and as he shouted, "I'm from Australia," they shot him into the harbor. We knew what they meant when they said Australia. Australia had almost raised no peep. in protest of what had happened. Maybe it was explained by a few years later, the foreign minister of Indonesia and Australia went together in a plane and signed the Timor Gap Treaty dividing up the oil spoils, Timor's oil, between Australia and Indonesia. Oil has caused so much pain in the world. So we said, we're from America, America. And they'd kick me. When I get my breath back, I'd say America, as the other soldiers joined in the firing line with the guns at our heads. They had stripped us of everything. I only had my passport left. I threw it at them. It said America. And finally, they decided to pull the guns from our heads. We think because we were from the same country that their weapons were from, they would have to pay a price for killing us. They'd never had to pay for killing the Timorese. And they just moved on and kept killing. We got into a Red Cross Jeep. Dozens of Timorese jumped on top of us, on top of the van, hung off of the spare tire at the back, and we drove like that as a human mass to the hospital. When we got there, we were certainly not in worse shape than the Timorese, though Alan was covered in blood. When the nurses and doctors saw him, they started to cry. I think because of what we represent to the world, we represent two things. We represent the sword. So often, the U.S. government has provided military weapons to repressive regimes around the world. But we also represent the shield, the American people. The smallest thing that we do right here in the number one superpower on Earth has such a tremendous ripple effect around the world. Just a call to a Congress member or telling your neighbor about something that has happened, a story you've heard about a child in Iraq, makes an enormous difference because of where we are. And they understand that. And on that day, that shield was bloodied, and it only furthered their despair. The Indonesian military killed more than 270 Timorese on that one day, November 12, 1991. Fast forward 10 years, the people of East Timor won their freedom. In 1999, they finally got a chance to vote in a referendum of self-determination, and they voted for their freedom. Alan and I returned to Timor May 20th, 2002. May 19th, just as midnight struck, Xanana Gusmao, the rebel leader of Timor who'd been imprisoned for so many years by the Indonesians and had just been voted president of Timor, ascended the stage of Tasitolo, a sandy plain outside of Dili. 100,000 Timorese were there as he raised the flag of the Democratic Republic of East Timor. And the fireworks went off, and we watched as the people looked up at this display like they had never seen. And we saw the light reflected in their tear-stained faces. This nation of survivors had lost so much, had been through so much, had paid such a high price, but they had won. They had resisted, and they had won. It was a truly remarkable moment. And it just made me realize how important it is what people do in their lives. They won because of their own unbelievable resistance and determination and persistence. And they won because of the support of people all over the world. Here in this country, it didn't matter if you're Republican or Democrat or Independent or Green. That's not what mattered. When you heard the story, you did something. You made a call. You went to a movie to learn more. You read a book. Congress said they got more calls on this issue, surprisingly enough, on Timor in the 90s than on any other foreign policy issue over a certain period of time. And it really rang a bell for them because every time one person called, it was worth 100 calls because it was such an obscure issue. ABC, NBC, CBS had never covered it in the 17 years from the invasion to the massacre. 1991, never said the words East Timor, even though it was worse than the genocide proportionately in Cambodia. But the people in Timor believed and they won. And the lesson I take away from this is that we have a decision to make every day, every hour of every day, and whatever we choose to do, whether we're teachers or students, journalists or doctors, nurses, employed or unemployed, retired or just starting out in life. We have a most important decision to make, whether we want to represent the sword or the shield. Democracy Now. Thank you.